the scholars. Asked what is Buddhism, off they go. Consult the dictionaries, row on row. Sanskrit, Tibetan, Pali, German too. As though it was the only thing to do. Until we wish, in all sincerity, a second burning of the books could be. Have they no other word for sick souls full of doubt, then? Read my latest article. Off with your shoes. 'Tis holy ground. Depart. Buddhism's in the life and in the heart. So the first line of the poem envisages a certain situation. A situation in which someone has just heard about Buddhism and they want to find out more about it. They want to know what Buddhism is. So they start looking for someone to ask, someone who can tell them what Buddhism is. They start looking for an authority on Buddhism. So as we usually do in all sorts of spheres of life, they start turning to the specialists, they turn to the scholars, the academics, and they ask them, not of course directly, not face to face, so to speak, but through their books, they ask them, what is Buddhism? As I've said, the poem was of course written in 1957. At that time, there were comparatively few books on Buddhism available. There were comparatively few translations of sutras, especially Mahayana sutras. I remember whenever a new translation of a Mahayana sutra came out, we were very, very excited. It was a real gift. They weren't easily or readily available. There were very few of them. And we valued those early translations, imperfect though they were, very, very highly. But even the translations of the sutras were the work, mostly, of scholars who were not Buddhists. But we had no alternative, in many cases, to turn to the scholars. That is, especially if we happened to be living in the West. Now, it mustn't be thought that I'm just criticizing those early scholars. They certainly did their best, and so we should be grateful to them. At least something of the Dharma usually managed to shine through, to percolate through their writings. But on what were those writings based? When the scholars in the poem are asked, what is Buddhism? What do they do, so to speak? They go and consult the dictionaries. Dictionaries of the canonical Buddhist languages, the languages in which the Buddhist scriptures are written. Also consult dictionaries of modern European languages. Not only that, they consult them as though it was the only thing to do. So what does that all mean? We'll have to go into it a little. But first of all, a few words on the question of consulting the dictionaries. I don't want to give the impression that I think it's wrong to consult the dictionaries. This is very far from being the case. I think, in fact, that we should consult them very much more than we actually do in most cases. Most of us, it has to be admitted, speak and write very badly. We have a very poor command of our own language. And because we have a poor command of our own language, we can't communicate our thoughts and our feelings to others effectively. And in this way, all sorts of misunderstandings between people arise. Very often we've only a vague, general sort of idea of the meaning of the words we use. And sometimes, of course, we confuse words that sound alike. One confusion that really does irritate me sometimes is that between militate and mitigate. I discovered that confusion, that confused use of one of these words, believe it or not, in yesterday's Daily Telegraph, in an article by a quite intelligent person where I hadn't really expected to find it. And then, of course, people confuse affect and effect. One finds this even in writings on Buddhism. And in other words, people's vocabulary is often very limited. The total number of words in the English language is said to be somewhere between 400,000 and 600,000. It's quite a lot of words. But most of us use habitually only a couple of thousand. Some people, it's said, use habitually only a few hundred words. So think how we overwork certain words. We overwork words like nice, have a nice day, a nice book, a nice meal, a nice film, nice meditation. Almost anything can be nice. And then fantastic. This is a word that, well, young people, it seems, are very fond of using. This, that, and the other is fantastic. Won't give you any examples. And then devastated. Every day I hear on the radio or read in the paper about people being devastated. Well, someone loses his job, he's devastated. His football team doesn't win the match, he's devastated. His father dies, he's devastated, of course. Well, he hasn't any stronger word to use, because he used that word devastated in so many different ways, in so many different contexts. So a range of expression becomes fairly restricted, and we therefore need to consult the dictionary much more than we do. If we consult the dictionary, it'll help clarify and refine our use of words, and we'll be able to express ourselves better and communicate better, whether in speech or in writing. And of course, if we consult the dictionary, it'll help us to think more clearly. Personally, I must say, I do consult the dictionary quite a lot. In fact, when I'm writing, whether it's writing memoirs or even a letter, I habitually consult three dictionaries, just to make sure, because they don't always give quite the same definitions or explanations of words. I consult Collins. I'm not doing any advertising for them. I consult the Concise Oxford, and I consult my dear old friend Dr. Johnson's dictionary, a facsimile copy of which a kind friend presented me with quite a few years ago. And of course, for emergencies, when Collins and the Concise Oxford and even Dr. Johnson isn't of any help, there's the great 12-volume Oxford English Dictionary to fall back on. And I also consult the Thesaurus. When I'm writing, I ask myself the meaning or the meanings of the particular words I'm using. Is it quite the right word? First thoughts are by no means always the best. I think any practicing poet or practicing writer can tell you that. So I ask myself, well, does this particular word that I'm using or thinking of using convey the precise shade of meaning, of thought, of feeling, of suggestion, of resonance that I want to communicate? I ask myself this question with regard to almost every important word that I set down on paper, especially if I'm writing something like my memoirs. So these sort of questions when I'm writing, I ask myself all the time. And then, of course, there's the question of spelling and punctuation and syntax and grammar, but I'm not going to go into all that, otherwise the lecture will sound much too much like a lesson. So we need to consult the dictionary. The dictionary, we may say, is the writer's best friend. That is, his best friend as a writer. And the dictionary is also the reader's best friend as a reader. Because if in your reading you come across a word you don't quite understand, look it up, or make a note to look it up later on. Otherwise you may well miss something of the author's meaning, miss a subtlety which may be quite important. I hope I'm not labouring the point. But as I said a little while ago, I get lots of letters from people. Some of those letters, even from... Well, some of them are quite well written. A few of them are very well written. But I have to confess, not only letters, but even reportings in to various journals that I think I'd better not mention, show that the writer has quite a poor command of his or her, usually his, own language. And this can give rise to all sorts of problems, all sorts of miscommunications and therefore misunderstandings. Apart from the fact it's not very pleasant to read, you know, clumsy and badly written items of any kind, coming from whatsoever source. So I think the moral of it is we should be proud of our mother tongue, whatever it happens to be, and we should do our best to speak it and write it correctly, effectively, and as beautifully as possible.